This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on June 8th, 2011. Tonight we're talking to Eric Lawrence. Eric is a program manager on the IE team. He also has run the Fiddler freeware tool for a number of years and has a lot of other cool freeware utilities that are available. And let me see, he also has the IE internals blog, which is a great resource for finding out what a lot of kind of cool under the hood things. And a lot of your focus, Eric, is on HTTP, not just in Fiddler, but also on your blog and I assume on the IE team, right?
Yeah, I started out as a networking program manager on the Internet Explorer team back in 2004. And I now run the team that owns networking as well as a couple other core components. So yeah, I have a pretty deep affinity for the HTTP protocol going back quite a few years.
Okay. And you know, this wasn't intentional, but we just recently, last week, we had an interview with Glenn Block, who's working on the WCF web API framework. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but that's kind of taking a more HTTP-centric view of calling network resources from .NET. So,
yeah, it's kind of interesting. There's tons of stuff that goes on in HTTP, and .NET offers a bunch of abstractions and sort of higher level constructs, which is always fun because, you know, even though I'm mostly a .NET programmer, you know, I stay within a pretty narrow portion of .NET, and it's sort of funny because I feel like a grizzled assembly language guy looking at the rest of the .NET world and sort of shaking my fist at the abstractions and hey, people don't know what's going on the wire and stuff like that. And it's kind of funny that the role reversal there has occurred, where oftentimes people will come to me with issues at a higher level in ASP.NET or things like that, and I'm mostly interested in, well, what's on the wire. and so it's fun. But I'm not super privy to the WCF stuff, although a bunch of people have written extensions for Fiddler to show WCF encoded binary and things like that.
So Eric, we should clarify that you're on the IE team, but you're not responsible for the rendering DOM stuff, right?
No. So basically, I'm the program manager lead for the fundamentals team. So we own things like security and privacy and reliability and networking. So no, I don't own the DOM or anything like that. But by virtue of the fact that I have a fairly public blog, as well as kind of get out in the community quite a lot, I end up with tons of questions from all over the product.
Now, you mentioned that you're primarily a .NET programmer.
Yeah, so my languages of choice are C# primarily. And I actually still do wrangle a bit of Delphi now and again, but mostly that's for tools that I started writing in the late 90s, and I've just been sort of keeping on life support for their relatively smaller communities for the last decade or so.
So I thought that I had heard you say at some point that Fiddler was written in Delphi as well.
No, so back in the day, I had pondered writing Fiddler in Delphi, but I ultimately concluded that it just never would work because the amount of sort of security and other concerns around writing native code. And so I had originally put together sort of a prototypal UI in Delphi, but it never had any real functionality. And then at the time, when I started writing Fiddler, I had actually never written anything of any sort of value in C#. And so I sort of very boldly sat down and said, well, I don't know HTTP and I don't know C#, but I really need an HTTP debugger, so I'm going to write one in C#. And after about 6 months or so of a lot of weekends, I came out with something which was very, very primitive compared to what I have today, but a greater understanding of C# and .NET and of HTTP as well.
Okay. So at Mix, you gave a talk called The Devil Went Down to HTTP, and you talked about a lot of new things that came out in Fiddler. And I've, like probably most, web developers working and any web developer pretty much has dealt with Fiddler at some point. And I was surprised, though, about how many of these new features you were showing off. And One specifically that I wasn't aware of was how the architecture lets you work with a lot of, like, not just with Internet Explorer, but it also works with Firefox and with other browsers.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of this comes back to just kind of a lack of knowledge on my part. And that is, you know, the cool kids that are writing their network interception systems for their browsers are mostly doing, detours or thunking functions and so forth. And that's great in some respects, if you're a hardcore low-level hacker type. Although it tends to build really fragile code, because anytime the internals change, your code is either going to have to change or it's going to start crashing. Whereas with Fiddler, basically it works as a standard HTTP proxy. And there's some downsides of that, mostly related to observer effects, which I've worked pretty hard to mitigate as much as possible. But the upside is that literally anything that supports an HTTP proxy, you can use Fiddler against. And the advantage of that is it means it works with all browsers and it works with virtually all devices. And so whether you've got your iPhone or your iPad or your Windows Phone 7 device, you can actually use Fiddler with it. And, you know, there's occasional sort of regressions and certain spaces. I think Android might currently be broken because they don't allow you to set proxies in the normal way for Android. But they may have fixed that for now. And so that's, you know, one of the advantages of being a proxy server.
Well, so it's not just for web devving either. I worked with system admins who will use it when they're trying to debug application delivery controller problems, like with some of the NetScaler or the big IPs from F5. They want to look at the headers that are coming across and they want to see, okay, so do we have that rule turned on properly? Or, you know, what are the headers doing? Why are we getting these, you know, responses back in this amount of time? And using it for not necessarily network traces, but for, you know, debugging kind of things that those smart router kind of things are doing that you don't get to deal with much when you're a web dev.
Yeah, there's definitely a bunch of use cases. I mean, one of the sort of little known facts about Fiddler is how ridiculously popular it is, to the point where when I first saw the metrics numbers, at the time that I first sort of had kind of my alarmist moment was when I was seeing that I was hitting about 8,000 downloads a day. You know, my first thought was there's no possibility that there are 8,000 web devs a day that are discovering this tool and, you know, just installing it. And so I started to look a bit more at kind of where the traffic was coming from. And it turns out that Fiddler is useful for a very, very broad set of people. There's people who are, you know, running ad campaigns and they're trying to make sure that they're getting their ads, you know, served with the right, you know, parameters. There are metrics tracking folks that want to make sure their tracking beacons are working correctly. There's people that are trying to make sure that their compression devices are compressing their traffic and so forth. And so, yeah, there's a very broad section of users. Amusingly, there's also, I would say, probably the majority of Fiddler users are not technical and are not web developers and are using Fiddler for sort of other unintended purposes, which makes it really interesting to kind of try and build a tool that scales across that broad of an audience. The other thing is, you know, IE9, prior to IE9, Internet Explorer actually didn't have a lightweight HTTP traffic feature. And so if you wanted to see even things like, hey, am I sending the proper caching headers on this response, you needed something like Fiddler. And with IE9's new F12 developer tools, we have a network tab that will show you some of that information. And so some of the use cases for Fiddler go away when you have browsers that have these features. But because, as John had earlier pointed out, you know, there's tons of devices and compatibility with other browsers and so forth, Fiddler has a pretty passionate user base that uses it across a lot of different scenarios.
We used it for security testing of web apps too, because you could manipulate the request to a certain extent, but you could also see, you know, so when I put this text into the text box, does it come back anywhere in the headers or the response body or anything like that?
Yep, absolutely. And some folks, some really good white hat folks have written some plugins for Fiddler that automate that. The Kasaba security guys have a variety of plugins that plug into Fiddler that are available from the Fiddler download page that will do some automated security testing, which is super cool. And there's also a community of folks that use Fiddler for security testing, both for the good guys and probably for the more dubious guys. I've heard that at some conferences, some of the demos are done with Fiddler, although I've never actually been to one of those.
So, and one of those is a fuzz testing thing, right? One of those plugins?
So there's a few. So there's the Kasaba guys offer Watcher, which is what they call a passive security auditor. And what they do is they do mostly static analysis as you browse around the site looking for cases where you're not following security best practices, like you've failed to set a character set on an HTTP response, or you're not using HTTP-only cookies and other things that potentially expose you to risk. They have a different plugin called X5S, which my recollection is that it's mostly a Unicode tool that's testing for sort of edge conditions around Unicode in responses. And then a member of the community has published a Burp-like, Burp is a competitive security fuzz testing tool, a Burp-like tool for doing fuzzing of responses. And then, you know, internally to various companies, I've heard that people have private fuzz testing extensions that they plug into Fiddler. Most of those don't get shipped publicly because they turn out to be quite effective at finding bugs.
So can we talk a little bit about what fuzz testing is and kind of how that's useful?
So the general idea of fuzz testing is that you're trying to, you know, see how an application or a server or service deals with unexpected input. And so, you know, the typical way that you do this, there's sort of two types of fuzz testing. There's dumb fuzzing and smart fuzzing. And it turns out that dumb fuzzing, where you're just blindly kind of throwing bits against the wall to see what stick, can find an entire, you know, a very large set of bugs. The unfortunate part of dumb fuzzing is very often, you know, when you're done, you're dumb fuzzing, you still have quite a few bugs. And the reason is because sometimes doing analysis requires a, you know, getting back past sort of the first level of defense and getting a little deeper. And so a great example would be, you know, if you're trying to fuzz a server to see how it handles a malformed HTTP request, you can, you know, throw all kinds of stuff against the server and see if it handles long inputs or exceptionally short inputs or inputs that are missing some of their required components and so forth. But that will only find some of the bugs. To, you know, get the deepest class of bugs, you have to go a little bit further and understand, oh, well, this particular server is expecting a XML payload of this particular format. And if it doesn't get an XML payload in that format, then it'll just reject it. But if I give it an XML payload of that format, but the value of one of the attributes in the XML is this unexpected string, the server will blow up. And so smart fuzzing finds a new class of bugs. And so you can use Fiddler to generate either. But the value in some cases is the ability to do sort of mutating fuzzing. And so the notion there is you start out with a set of valid inputs and you have Fiddler just subtly change things as they go. And so, you know, you get your normal response, except that, oh, anytime I encounter this, I'll randomly flip, you know, one of these characters. And so by using a tool like Fiddler, where you start out with normal traffic and then you just alter bits of it, you can do a bit smarter fuzzing. The challenge with Fiddler in the fuzzing scenario is that Fiddler is mostly intended as a protocol debugger. And for most cases, it will not allow you to generate inputs that violate the rules of HTTP. And so if, for instance, you know, you've got a service that's expecting the content length header to be accurate, Fiddler is not generally a good way to sort of try and test to make sure the server understands that assumption, because Fiddler will make sure the content length is accurate because it doesn't want to generate invalid traffic. And so for scenarios where you're actually trying to fuzz the protocol implementation, the HTTP protocol implementation, you usually need to use something other than Fiddler. But for a very broad class of fuzzing, whether you're fuzzing the payloads, you're testing the servers, or you're testing the clients, Fiddler can be very useful.
You were talking earlier about using, since it's a proxy, it can be used for a variety of devices, including mobile. and I've heard more and more that people are using that. How exactly do you set that up? How do you have a phone calling through Fiddler that's running on my desktop?
So the general scenario there is the device needs to support Wi-Fi. And so in most cases, that's not too much of a challenge. And you can also sometimes do it in tethering scenarios. And so the example that, you know, I use most is the Windows Phone 7, because Windows Phone 7 can use the network either via Wi-Fi or via tethering in the Zune client. Interestingly, the Windows Phone guys, despite using Fiddler a lot internally, haven't made it any easier. And so, unfortunately, there's a couple of little tricks that you need to know in order to do your Windows Phone traffic debugging with Fiddler. And I've published those up on the Fiddler blog, as well as sort of the Fiddler help site. But to debug over Wi-Fi, basically, you just join the same wireless network that your PC is a member of, and then in the Windows Mobile proxy settings, you provide the host name of your server running or your computer running Fiddler, and you know, tell it to use port 8888, which is Fiddler's default port, and then subsequently the traffic will flow over Wi-Fi to the desktop instance of Fiddler, and then out to the network. And so, you know, that's kind of one of the scenarios where people are doing testing of the application. Because it's doing a cross-machine scenario, there's some other things. Like if you want to debug secure traffic, you've got to configure your device to trust the Fiddler root certificate and things like that. And so, you know, it's different configuration steps. On the Apple devices, it's very similar. Basically, join the Wi-Fi network, point the wireless configuration proxy settings at the Fiddler instance, and go from there. One of the sort of interesting gotchas that I've run into and resolved very recently is that the Apple iOS devices, so the iPad and the iPod, you know, the iPod Touch and so forth, as well as the iPhone, all have a subtly different certificate requirement for secure traffic than every other device and browser. And so they require certificates that have a particular piece of information set in them. And unfortunately, internally, Fiddler uses MakeCert, which is just a command line tool that ships with Visual Studio for making certificates on the fly. And it uses that for its HTTP interception. And so, unfortunately, MakeCert doesn't set the flag that's required by iOS. And so this was sort of a blocking change for people who are trying to use the tool to decrypt traffic from the iOS devices until relatively recently. And this was resolved by effectively making Fiddler certificate architecture pluggable. And so there's a great open source library for doing certificate generation called Bouncy Castle. And it was a port from Java to C#, is the version that Fiddler has the ability to call. And so there's now a downloadable module for iOS compatible HTTPS decryption for Fiddler. And that's a very, very new thing. That's happened actually since Mix earlier this year. And it's still in a bit of an alpha stage, but it works pretty well. And so you can actually decrypt traffic from the iOS devices using Fiddler as well.
So the two big kind of tricky things that Fiddler's doing, one being a proxy and two decrypting, both of those are, I guess people might assume that, you know, you're on the IE team and so you've got some kind of secret, you know, knowledge of, I mean, obviously your knowledge pays off. It's your, you know, it's your job to know this stuff, but you're not using any kind of secret API kind of stuff. I mean, what you're doing is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, basically, you know, there's nothing secret about how Fiddler works. You know, we'll talk probably in a minute about one of the advantages of being on the IE team. But yeah, there's really no magic in what Fiddler is doing here. And in fact, there are other tools that sort of work in the same general way. And so, you know, the irony is I didn't set out to write an HTTP debugger. I was set out to sort of debug web traffic from a particular client. When I first joined Microsoft, I worked on, believe it or not, the Clipart team. And we had a Clipart website and we had a Clipart client, and the client needed to get Clipart from the website. And at the time, the debugging experience involved setting Visual Studio breakpoints and then hovering over strings and looking at the tooltip to try and see whether you could see enough of the HTTP request in the tooltip to make any sense of it. And that was a pretty horrible experience. And so, you know, I spent a bunch of time kind of looking for tools that would do what we needed. And at the time, I couldn't find any. Part of the problem was the tools didn't really exist in many cases. And the other part was they were just very hard to find because, you know, while everybody was sort of using HTTP, the notion of debugging at that level had not really taken off. And so the only tool that we actually had even seen was there's a very, very primitive tool called Achilles. And Achilles allowed you to modify a single HTTP request at a time. And it couldn't handle things like compressed traffic, and it couldn't handle things like authentication and so forth. And so it wasn't really a starter. But it gave me sort of some degree of confidence of, hey, I can do that, and I can do it better. And fortunately, over the years, as I discovered competitors to Fiddler or they entered the scene, I'd already invested so much in it that I couldn't really give up at that point and say, oh, no, we're just going to use this other thing. I instead said, hey, well, what's good about that other tool, and how do I do something that's that good or better?
So I think one of the big ways that you've been able to keep Fiddler relevant and over the answer to a lot of our questions so far have been, you know, well, there's a plugin for that. And so the plugin model has obviously worked very well for you.
Yes. So it's actually kind of a funny story because, you know, I don't know. I'm getting old. I don't remember a lot. But I do remember the origins of the Fiddler's plugin experience. And so inside Microsoft, we have a bug tracking tool called Product Studio, or at the time, I think it was called RAID. And the idea is there's this filtering UI within this tool that allowed you to search for bugs. And basically, you could imagine a big stack of combo boxes where you pick, okay, the bug is assigned to Joe, and its bug ID is, you know, something, or it was filed since this time. And so you can create an entire set of query operations for it. And the thing about it was, you know, I wanted something like that for Fiddler, where I could say, hey, I want, you know, the ability to look for HTTP requests that are returning images and they're bigger than 50K and they come from servers that end in .com. And so I really wanted that for Fiddler. People wanted something to be able to filter that traffic down so they could concentrate on what they care about. Unfortunately, I'm very lazy, and I looked at how to build that UI, and I thought, man, you know, that's really kind of hard, and it's a bunch of UI stuff, and I don't really like UI, and, you know, if only people could just write their queries in kind of like, oh, I don't know, SQL or maybe C Sharp or something like that, then that would be great. And, you know, around that time, I started poking around in the .NET framework, and I found how ridiculously easy it is to add a script engine. And so you can add the JavaScript script engine or the VBScript script engine using the VSA classes, the Visual Studio for Applications, I think is what it's supposed to stand for, classes. And so in roughly a page of code, you can write a model that allows you to, you know, load any arbitrary script file and run it and have it run against your object model. And so that's where Fiddler script came from, was this notion of, well, I'm really kind of too lazy to build the UI that I want, but I can kind of defer the work and put it out onto users, and they can write it in JavaScript. And, you know, JavaScript is for web devs, so they should know how to write JavaScript. It's actually JavaScript.net, so that's a little bit weird. And so that's kind of where the first extensibility point for Fiddler came from, and that's what helped to start, you know, get it to a broader audience, because it wasn't just for people, you know, trying to debug clip art. Suddenly people around the office team started using it for their scenarios, and it expanded from there. And then eventually I added a extensibility model based on sort of just .NET in general and Reflection. And so you can write plugins in any .NET language. And that sort of came from, you know, a bunch of .NET programmers started picking up Fiddler and saying, JavaScript.NET, seriously? Like, people don't write code in that. Can I just write in C#, please? And so that's kind of where it landed. It's sort of interesting because, you know, since that time, Visual Studio, the .NET framework in general, has added tons of new classes around doing this kind of thing, the managed extensibility framework, and I think there's probably been at least three or four.
That was my next question. Was
other
about math,
other yeah. types of things based, you know, basically, you know, getting this into more applications. And, you know, I haven't even really kept up on kind of what the new hotness is there and so forth. And, you know, for me, I've got sort of a real compatibility problem of sort of migrating people over. And so, you know, Fiddler's basically still based purely on reflection. And so you just build an assembly that has classes that are attributed in a particular way that implement interfaces, and Fiddler will, you know, dynamically discover them and load them and run the code in them. And they're very easy to write. And so it turns out that that generates a lot of folks that are, you know, extending Fiddler in really interesting and in sometimes surprising and or shocking ways. So one of the things that came up recently is there's been sort of a renewed interest in running Fiddler on .NET 4 directly. And the current version of Fiddler, the current ship version of Fiddler, doesn't run cleanly on .NET 4 for a variety of reasons. And so just in the past 2 weeks, I've started to take a closer look at that. And it turns out there's a very small set of sort of minor sort of bugs there that I've cleaned up. And then there's one sort of larger issue, which is, you know, I've been worried about the Fiddler script scenario breaking for quite some time, because Fiddler script is based on VSA. And starting in Visual Studio 2005, VSA has been deprecated. And so every time I compile, it's, you know, hey, this is going away in some future version of the framework. And so I've been kind of holding my breath, waiting it for it to happen. And when I first tried to compile on .NET 4, I got a ton of compiler errors in this space. And I said, oh man, they finally did it. They finally killed it. Man, I'm going to have to, you know, really think this through and move to the iCode compiler interfaces, which is mostly probably just some syntactic sugar, but it's not, in theory, going to have the ability to, you know, do dynamic unloading of assemblies and so forth. And I don't actually even know whether VSA is doing that properly under the covers, but I like to think that it does. But I just discovered 2 or 3 days ago, actually, that in .NET 4, they actually haven't killed VSA. They just moved it into a different assembly. And so I actually have a version that's currently floating around internally that runs purely on .NET 4. It's running, you know, with the main Fiddler assemblies all compiled with .NET 4. And fortunately, the way the .NET framework team made sort of versioning work, there is backward compatibility. And so you can actually load assembly plugins that were coded against .NET 2 in the version 4 of Fiddler. And it does work, surprisingly enough. And so at some point in the future, you'll probably see a pure .NET 4 version of Fiddler.
And what's the main driver for the pure .NET 4 version? Is it performance, or is it... Or just not requiring previous version, and you know.
Yeah. So it's the not requiring previous versions of .NET. And so Windows 7 ships with the version 2 CLR. Mm-hmm. We'll just leave it at that.
is there a potential of using the client profile?
So I've looked at client profile. So one of the big things that many people on this call may be interested in, on this webcast or whatever it is we're doing here, might be interested in is that Fiddler is actually an application which at least logically is built on top of a class library called Fiddler Core. Fiddler Core is an assembly that any .NET programmer can download and drop in their project to get a fully functioning intercepting proxy within their application. And so people have used Fiddler Core for all kinds of crazy purposes. But one of the scenarios that I wanted to make sure worked really well is that it didn't require the full .NET framework, the non-client profile. And so Fiddler Core is actually client profile clean. And so you can actually run Fiddler Core within your application using just the client profile. The full version of Fiddler requires a little bit of beyond the client profile, and I've been kicking around whether or not to sort of eliminate that requirement. Specifically, what it's using is within the text encoder. So on the tools menu, there's an encoder that allows you to convert between things like UTF-7 text and plain text, or percent encoded URLs to plain text, and back and forth. And so some of those are using classes from system.web that are primarily used by ASP.NET. And so I would have to rewrite about 9, I think, string encoding functions using my own implementations in order to get rid of the non-client profile dependency. And that probably will happen when I finally do get a full 4.0 port out there, just because getting to the client profile is absolutely a great thing about decreasing the requirement on the user.
So what are some of the things you mentioned? People are doing some crazy things with Fiddler Core. That was something, honestly, that I'd never heard of before at your mixed talk, and that seems to open up a huge, like you're saying, you could drop it into any .NET app, and then you have an intercepting proxy at that point.
Yeah, and so a lot of people are using it within their test frameworks, and so they'll actually put it in their test harness, and they will have it log sort of test case results directly to databases with no UI and sort of none of Fiddler, no end user sort of notice of what's going on. There's an open source error tracking framework. I wish I could remember the name of it. It's like Elmo or Elma. Or something like that.
Yeah, E-L-M-A-H. Elma.
Yeah, there you go. Great. Yep. Talk to .NET guys. They know what I'm talking about. And so I believe that there's a module for that that allows you to actually integrate Fiddler Core, and it will collect network traffic captures within it. And so those can be submitted as part of bug reports. Myself, I mentioned earlier, Fiddler actually is not built on top of Fiddler Core. Logically, it is, but the reality is it's just cross-compiled out of the same source files. An application that is built on Fiddler Core is what I call Fiddler Cap. And so if you go to fiddlercap.com, basically it's a little sort of 10-step checklist that explains to, kind of a non-technical home user how to download this little Fiddler Cap tool. And the notion of Fiddler Cap is that it's sort of like a problem step recorder for people that are having problems with a given website. And so the Hotmail support team, for instance, can tell a user, hey, you seem to be having problems with Hotmail. Can you go run this tool, push, collect, go visit the website, do whatever's broken, click stop and save, and actually submit to us a traffic capture so that we can see things as you see them. And so this is a really powerful thing for, web developers to get insight into what's going wrong in production. And so Fiddler Cap is actually built on top of Fiddler Core, just as a normal Fiddler Core-based application. And then there's other people that are doing myriad other things with Fiddler Cap. A lot of them, I actually don't even get the full picture of what they're doing with them. They just ask, a little technical question about, hey, can you make it so I can have multiple proxy listeners within my process? Or, hey, I plan on creating, proxy listeners, 50 per minute, and I need to be a long-running process and process a million sessions without, anything bad happening. So can you improve the scale and things like that? And so I'm not entirely sure what all the scenarios even are. But a lot of them are related to sort of web testing and web capture type scenarios.
Okay. You mentioned that you're taking advantage of some new things in IE9. I see on the site here's including X-Download Initiator.
Yeah. So basically, this is what I alluded to earlier. One of the advantages of being on the IE team is I get to be sort of I don't even know how to call it exactly, a bit of a troublemaker when it comes to some of our feature planning. And so there were a couple of places where I managed to get some changes in the IE9 plan that make proxy-based debugging a little bit simpler. And one of them is around basically enabling the proxy to have some idea about why a given HTTP request is made. And so this is something that you can see today. So if you go into the IE9 F12 developer tools and go to the network tab and go load a page with the network tab capturing, you'll see there's a column called initiator. And the initiator column explains why a given HTTP request is made. Oh, this is actually an image request for this image tag. And so that's a cool feature. And it's something that's very useful helpful to know. But unfortunately, because of where a proxy sits, a proxy has no idea why a given request was made. And so what we have in IE9 is there's actually a feature control key that you can set that tells Internet Explorer to start sending that information as a custom HTTP header. And in that way, Fiddler can actually pick up that information and display it within the debug environment. And you can have Fiddler strip out that header so it doesn't actually go to the server if you'd like. And so that's one of the things that we did. One of the other things that we were able to do is one of the longest standing limitations of Fiddler was that .NET developers who were using like the Cassini Visual Studio web test server would find that none of their traffic was showing up in Fiddler. And the reason is because the WinINet network stack underneath Fiddler had this hard-coded bypass that said, hey, if the traffic is going to localhost, which the Cassini traffic does, then don't proxy it no matter what. And so we managed to get a change into WinINet so that Fiddler actually sets an option on WinINet that says, no, please proxy the localhost traffic. I'm running locally and I need to see it. And so in IE9, you can actually just hit F5 in an ASP.NET project or a Silverlight project, and your traffic will actually go through Fiddler. And so that was one of the other advantages that we were able to put into IE9 in order to make this scenario work better.
You're mentioning that you're a bit of a troublemaker. So I remember when Cassini wasn't working well with early builds of IE9 internally, and I watched that you were kind of making that get fixed. Which
so
was cool.
That's a fantastic segue, actually, into sort of both IE internals and kind of some things that are going on, current events. And so IE internals is a blog that I run on MSDN. So it's just blogs.msdn.com, WACB, WAC. IE internals. And I get to sort of post about interesting things going on in the IE world and things that I discover. And oftentimes I blog about bugs. And so the issue with the Cassini server is really an interesting one. And it's interesting for a couple of reasons. But the reason that it's particularly interesting that you bring it up today is World IPv6 Day. And the issue with the Cassini server relates to the fact that it runs only on IPv4 and not IPv6. And so the problem that we were having with early builds of IE9 is IE9 has this feature called background connections. And when you first make a connection to a given website, Internet Explorer 9 will actually make two connections, because we've done a bunch of data analysis and found out that in almost all cases, you need more than one connection anyway. And by establishing two connections in parallel, we actually save potentially hundreds of milliseconds on the overall loading of a given page. And so the challenge that we had, or the problem that we encountered when we were doing Cassini with IE9, is that developers who were using Cassini found that in IE9 that hit F5 within Visual Studio, and Internet Explorer would open and show page cannot be displayed. And it turns out the reason is this. When Cassini opened IE, it said, please go to localhost on whatever port that Cassini is running. In Windows Vista and later, localhost maps to two addresses, :1, which is the IPv6 interface, and 127.0.0.1, which is the IPv4 interface. And the problem is, it turns out that the Cassini server is only listening on IPv4. And so what happens is both the foreground connection and our speculative background connection both attempt to make a connection to :1 first, because it's the first address in the address list. Well, they both fail. And so they both tell the address list, hey, I tried an address and it didn't work. Move on to the next one. Unfortunately, there was a bug in the code that said basically how to invalidate the record. And so instead of invalidating the first record twice, harmlessly the second time, instead we said, hey, we had two invalid addresses, and this address list is too long. And so there aren't any other addresses that we might try, so let's just give up now. And so in Cassini with IE9, in the beta, basically you'd hit F5 and you would always fail without question because of this bug.
Huh.
And so we fixed that bug very obviously by just invalidating the record only once and ignoring the second race condition invalidation. But it turns out that this is, an issue with IPv6 in general. in IE9 that we had gone overlooked, because it turned out that use of IPv6 in the real world was pretty low. But IPv6 is now becoming a much more common thing. And so, you know, obviously attention has increased on it. And today, a bunch of major websites flipped on IPv6 kind of for the first time as a test to see how well it was going to go. And so had we not fixed this bug before we shipped IE9, it would have been a catastrophe today, because nothing would have worked properly.
But oh, wow. So by fixing this for Cassini, this was actually a huge thing as far as...
Yes, as IPv6. And it turns out that, you know, in the course of this investigation, we identified that this problem actually goes back a very long way. And it was just the fact that the background connections feature created the timing conditions that would lead to this problem that made it 100% repro and made it relatively easy for us to go figure out what was going on. And so that was something that we had to address as an update to earlier Internet Explorer versions as well.
So you mentioned IPv6 day today, and you know, I played with it a little bit and very quickly found that, you know, my router wasn't set up right, and probably my proxy on my, you know, computer, and so not a lot worked well without me meddling with it. Is it the kind of thing where pretty much nobody or very few people are using this, except in, you know, large corporate scenarios or something, or where's the main use?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Certainly, you know, within organizations, IPv6 may be relatively common. We just wouldn't know, because you wouldn't really see the traffic kind of going across the network as a whole. So within Microsoft, for instance, we use IPv6 quite a lot. But most public websites do not actually currently offer IPv6 records. And they don't offer IPv6 records in many cases because misconfigurations are fairly common. And so there are several major ISPs in the world, and I've been on some mail about this recently, where they effectively will return IPv6 records, but will never allow you to connect to an IPv6 site. And worse than that, they will not allow you to connect to the site very, very, very slowly. And so, in fact, you will, you know, if you were to get an IPv6 record back, you know, it may take some amount of time, 10 or 20 seconds, for the connection to fail and your client to then fall over to the next address in the list. And if it's an IPv6 address, you would rinse and repeat. Whereas if it's an IPv4 address, then it would begin to properly work. And so one of the sort of goals of the IPv6 test day today was to sort of root out those problems and start to get the infrastructure cleaned up. And so there's that aspect of it. There's also a bunch of investigations sort of from client stacks about, is there something that we can do that's a little bit smarter here? So rather than doing, you know, preferring IPv6 to IPv4, which is actually important for a number of reasons, why not let them compete? So effectively attempt to connect to the IPv6 address, and if that doesn't succeed in a very short period of time, then also try and connect to an IPv4 address. And if it comes back before the IPv6 address comes back, then you say, maybe there's something weird about this network stack. Maybe I should pivot over to that other address. And so that's something that people are starting to experiment with to see whether or not that's the right path. But ideally, we would just see the infrastructure cleaned up so that people would be implementing IPv6 correctly. And we wouldn't need to sort of make the client implementations significantly more complicated.
Have you, I don't know if this would make a difference or not. I was going to say, have you looked at what SSL traffic look like over IPv6? Does it look any different? Is nothing else really to do there, is there? I don't think.
No, there's, I mean, in theory, SSL stuff shouldn't behave any differently. There's some really interesting things around, and I vaguely recall seeing some issues. I think I may have filed some issues on this around, if you're trying to do SSL to an IPv6 literal, which, you know, basically instead of having in your, you know, you could get a certificate in theory for a particular IP address and then connect to that IP address. And as long as the host name and the certificate matches, you'd be good to go. Now, in theory, no public certificate authority is ever going to issue you a certificate for an IP address because it's not bound to an organization name or anything like that, but you could create a self-signed cert. Well, one of the interesting things about IPv6 addresses is when they appear within a URL, they must appear within brackets. So, you know, it's http://open:\1:443/. And I believe that I found when I was doing testing that implementations varied as to whether or not the certificate's hostname had the brackets or not. And so I think with some browsers, if the bracket was there, the cert was accepted. And with some browsers, it wasn't. And so I don't think there was full interoperability about it. But because no public CA will ever issue a cert that way, it's not a terribly important thing. But other than that, no, I wouldn't expect to see any real difference in SSL traffic.
Another thing I was trying to think about, and maybe this is another where maybe no difference again, but for the longest time, everyone was just doing gets and posts and just thinking of, you know, not taking advantage of all the different headers that are available. And now that REST is becoming more and more interesting to people, I know there's kind of like some tunneling specifications where people just set a header that says, I wish this was a put if that was available. But I guess there's nothing really that's changed as far as either Fiddler or IE would be concerned with more RESTful-based development, is there?
Well, there's a couple of things of interest. So Fiddler already has the ability to flag traffic based on the HTTP method. And so if you want to make all of your puts appear in purple, you can very easily write a rule that does that. So Fiddler actually has pretty good knowledge and understanding of the HTTP methods, and it tries to have some awareness of whether or not a given request type is supposed to have a content body or not and things like that. Unfortunately, it used to be rather strict about the rules and would fail requests, for instance, if they were missing a body when they were defined to have one and things like that. And it turned out that unfortunately, the software ecosystem is not compatible necessarily with the specification or a strict reading of the specification. And so I mostly saw that with WebDAV. So WebDAV is the web distributed authoring versioning, which is, you know, somewhat similar to REST. It adds some additional methods for locking and unlocking and so forth. And I found that some of that didn't quite work the way that it was supposed to. Generally speaking, the risk with these sort of lesser known protocols is that there's some device along the line, whether it's a gateway or a proxy, that isn't really following the rules properly. And so maybe it caches the result, you know, as if it were a get and returns it to some subsequent request totally illegally. And the challenge is because REST traffic is relatively uncommon, those types of bugs may be sort of lingering in the infrastructure. And so that's there. In terms of changes to IE, I believe one of the changes that we made for IE9, or perhaps it was for IE8, was we removed the restriction as to which methods you're allowed to use for the native XML HTTP request object. And so previously, we had a very tightly controlled list of you may only use the following known methods. And we changed that code. So it's now just a block list of you may not use trace or track because there's a known security issue around those methods, but you can use anything else you want. And so that basically helps some folks who were trying to do RESTful things using the XML HTTP request object within the browser itself.
Kind of apropos of nothing other than this, just kind of reminded me of it. But one thing that I've run into when I've done HTTP related work, especially I remember working with the Twitter proxies and stuff, was the HTTP 100 continue. And is that something that, I don't know, you've run into or had to deal with much on?
Oh, absolutely. But only because of Fiddler. Basically, the notion behind a 100 continue is that, you know, the theory was this. Basically, the client browser, when it's doing a post in particular to a server, it will tell the server, hey, I'm about to give you, say, 5 megabytes of data, and it would be really nice if you would send me a 100 continue saying, do go on, if you're happy with that, or you would send me an error code saying, you know, I don't like that, it's too big or something like that early, so that I save my outbound bandwidth and we don't either one of us waste any time. And so that's the notion behind the 100, is the client sends a header that says, I expect to continue. But really, I, you know, expect continue is really more like, gee, it would be really nice if you sent a continue, but honestly, because so few sites do, I'm probably not going to get one. And so the client implementation very often will just begin its post anyway. And the server, in theory, can send back that 100 continue. But if it fails to do so, it will actually, you know, the client will just give up and send the data anyway in most cases. So this is particularly important for Fiddler, because Fiddler actually, as an HTTP proxy, this is the one scenario in HTTP where you could potentially get multiple sets of response headers for a single response. And within Fiddler, that's a really, really challenging problem from a UI perspective. How do you even show that to the user? And so for, you know, at first, before I knew what the 100 continue was, I think Fiddler just kind of broke when this happened. And, you know, I fixed that as soon as I found it. And what I started doing initially was I would just have Fiddler eat that expect continue. And that turned out not to break anything, and it didn't really matter. And then in later versions, I changed it so it would actually send it to the client immediately and not even show it within the Fiddler UI. Although if you right-click on a session and choose properties, you can see that expect continue within the properties dialog, the 100 continue response, rather. And so it turns out that it's interesting. In practice, most, I would say many clients don't care about it. And so, for instance, Internet Explorer doesn't have any particular provision to do anything with an expect continue. And in fact, WinINet will just kind of eat it on the response. It doesn't actually even read it until the request is done being sent. And so it doesn't actually do anything useful within IE. But you could certainly imagine building a client where that wasn't the case. And if you were building, for instance, a .NET client that was doing, you know, large file uploads or something like that, it certainly, you know, it seems like a fine idea to support. Although in practice, many servers will not send it.
And that kind of reminds me of another just kind of random thing I've stumbled across, which is the IE accept header. And I think that's something you blogged about kind of a while ago.
Yes, I did. So basically, there's a blog post on IE internals. There's actually two. There's the first post where I kind of expressed an opinion about the value of the accept header in general. And then there was the blog post in IE9 where I believe it was the same one I mentioned earlier about the enhancements for in IE9 for Fiddler. And one of the positive things in IE9 is that it sends a more reasonable accept header. So prior to IE9, basically the way that this worked was for a top-level document navigate, IE would very often send a very long string computed out of a variety of junk that was littered in the registry.
Oh, that's right. And, yep.
And for every other request on the page, it would send */*. Well, as it turns out, you can't really return just any response for most of the types on the page and expect to have it work properly. But the other problem was it wasn't even reliable that we would send the long string for a top-level navigate. And so if you were to, for instance, refresh the page, sometimes we would send the long string and sometimes we would send */*, and so forth. And so that was problematic. So for IE9, we actually just ripped that all out for IE9 standards mode. And so, IE9 browser mode. So in IE9 browser mode, when you're in sort of our latest standards mode, we will send a reasonable header. So we, for a top level document, we will ask for HTML or XHTML. For an image, we will ask for an image. For a style sheet, we will ask for a style sheet. And for script, we will ask for script. Amusingly, this has led to some problems. Like, for instance, when we ask for a style sheet, some PHP little frameworky things will, and Apache and some PHP modules will effectively get into a disagreement. The idea here is that Apache looks and says, hey, you know, this CSS file, purportedly, is mapped to this PHP script. And PHP isn't TextWax CSS, so I better return to the client, hey, I can't satisfy your request because I can't give you CSS. And it turns out that the problem, of course, is the PHP script, when it actually runs, will send a header, a response header of changing its content type to text CSS. And so if not for the helpfulness of the module, it would work just fine. But so I also wrote a blog post about that. So if you Google for IE, Bing for IE internals and 406, you'll find that problem listed there. And so, you know, ultimately we've cleaned up the accept handling in IE9. Turns out it causes some problems with websites because unfortunately, the standards-based web isn't quite here yet. But overall, the general notion behind accept, I believe to be not necessarily in line with the original ideas behind it. I don't think really kind of work for the web as it exists today. I think in practice on the web today, if you try and serve different content types from the same URL, odds are you will very quickly stop doing that as you find, you know, some proxy server doesn't really care about the very header and starts sending the wrong content type and so forth. And we've seen issues like this, in the wild where servers just aren't setting headers properly and bad things happen. And so one of the instances that we saw on our Microsoft corporate network is from time to time, someone will use a device, a mobile device through the corporate proxy to go visit, I think NBC.com was the site that had this issue for a while. And the NBC.com server would say, oh, well, this is a mobile device. Let me give you the WAP version of my page. And then subsequently, every single person in the entire company who's using their desktop browser to go to NBC.com ends up with the WAP mobile version of the page. Internet Explorer, of course, does not display WAP, and so the user gets a file download dialog. And so basically, it's a DOS to the a denial of service to the entire company when that happens. And so, generally speaking, I think that the accept mechanism is fairly fragile, and there's some cases where it's useful, but for the most part, using different URLs is probably the right way to go.
So you kind of brought up an interesting tangent there, in that there's a lot of unique opportunities for investigating traffic and traffic patterns at Microsoft that you don't get at other companies simply because of the heavy use of the network and the size of the network. And so I was wondering if you had any interesting stories or anything, in that case, specifically when you're trying to test out Fiddler or IE or anything else.
There's some advantages of being part of, a big company in terms of what you get to see. Interestingly, we don't necessarily have as much sort of internal insight as folks may expect, because when you think about a company the size of Microsoft, on one hand having, I have no idea how many people we have, it's, over 80,000, I think. On one hand, great, that's a ton of beta testers, it's wonderful. But the downside, of course, is that, with a team as small as ours, relatively, we can't actually handle the feedback from that many people at one time. And so people who are sort of using advanced versions of future browsers, it's actually only a fairly small subset of the company until we get to the public beta timeframe. And so we don't necessarily leverage it as much as one might hope. With Fiddler, I do have some cool opportunities, because Fiddler is a tool that gets used by a very significant percentage of the company. The number is actually kind of shocking. And they tend to use it with their newest, latest, and greatest technologies. And so if someone is making a change in either, say, Windows or some other component that makes Fiddler stop working, I usually end up getting an email pretty early on saying, hey, why doesn't this work? And it, gives me the opportunity to, go talk to the team responsible for the change and say, really, do you want to break all my users? Because that's not cool. But there are some advantages to that aspect of it.
So continuing on the theme of the random Fiddler questions, an error that I see pop up from time to time, and I thought of it because I literally just got it right now, is the Fiddler has detected a protocol violation.
Yes.
Pop up. What is that all about, and like, how worried should we be that we see this?
So the general hope is that if you ever see this on your website, well, actually, let me back that up a bit. The general hope is that if a tester ever sees this on a developer's website, he will go file a bug against the developer complaining, hey, you've done something wrong. I don't even know what it is, but Fiddler told me so. Please fix it. And so that's the overall notion, is that there are a variety of things where it turns out that browsers are astonishingly liberal in what they're willing to accept from servers. And that has greatly increased the complexity of writing a tool like Fiddler or a proxy in general. And so the protocol violation notifications in Fiddler in some ways are the mechanism by which I get to shout, you know, kids, get off my lawn. I'm an HTTP purist and you're not doing well. But, you know, the reality is that there are also sometimes real bugs that surface because of issues like this. And so sometimes something, you know, something wonky will be happening on a website. Nobody can figure it out. They fire up Fiddler and Fiddler immediately complains, hey, you said you were going to give me a megabyte of response, but you only gave me 800K. And that's not right. And, you know, browsers will just, you know, mostly for the most part, they'll just ignore the error and keep going on. They'll say, oh, I didn't get as much as I thought. Okay, whatever. I'm fine with that. And so, you know, I guess the way to look at it is they're a great diagnostic troubleshooting thing of, you know, if you happen to see one of those messages when you're debugging a scenario that's not working, chances are good that, you know, it's related to the problem at hand. But, you know, some of them are more pedantic than others. And so, for instance, one of the most common ones is the one that complains that the server's headers were terminated with just the, I think it's just carriage return instead of carriage return line feed or vice versa. Just line feed and not carriage return line feed. So whack R instead of whack R, whack N, and so forth. And that in browsers has no practical sort of implication, except that everybody that writes an HTTP client implementation has to understand that this kind of thing happens. And so that's a, you know, something to be aware of. And, you know, whether you need to do anything about it is kind of a separate question. One of the things that I thought was most interesting is there's been a long, you know, most people don't know there was an HTTP 0.9. You know, before Sir Tim released HTTP 1.0, there was a 0.9 version. And in the 0.9 version, there were no such things as HTTP headers. And so basically you would say, you know, get foo.jpg, and the server would just send you the bytes of foo.jpg and nothing else. And so for a long time, it was believed that, you know, no web server on the internet, surely, you know, being 2005 or 2006, there's certainly no server on the internet that's relying upon that capability. But it turns out that there were some. And so back at the time, one of the things people would see if they were browsing around Yahoo from time to time is they would see an HTTP protocol violation complaining that the server was using HTTP 0.9. And that's because Yahoo was just sending back response bytes with no headers at all. And so as browsers were talking about, hey, maybe we can remove HTTP 0.9 support, you know, I was able to say, well, you would break the following URLs on Yahoo were you to do that. And it's possible that Yahoo wasn't, you know, intentionally doing it, or there's some configuration problem in their server where they, you know, the headers were just getting eaten or something like that. But it does turn up useful things from time to time. I've considered, and at some point I will probably getting around to writing an HTTP lint module. And the HTTP lint module would be much, much more angry about many things that people do incorrectly in HTTP. So whether it's sending an E tag improperly or sending caching directives that actually contradict themselves or don't have any sense and things like that. And so at some point I'll go write that module, hopefully. But, you know, for the most part, the errors are fairly ignorable and you can actually turn them off using the tools options menu in Fiddler.
Wow. And there's like 9 million other questions I'd like to ask. I think we've got some good questions from listeners, so I should bring some of those in. James Schmidt asked if we'll see Fiddler features moving over to the IE dev tools. And I know you already mentioned that we're seeing that happen already. But is that something, do you work, like, is that something on, are the dev tools something that you manage as well or are related to? Is that?
So I don't work directly on the Internet Explorer dev tools. I do know the folks that do. Will we see Fiddler features move into the dev tools? Kind of. I mean, it's been an interesting thing. Since I joined the team, actually, there was this idea that in two versions of IE in a row, IE 7 and IE 8, you know, we had straw man somewhere, oh, let's port this Fiddler stuff into Internet Explorer. And that clearly isn't going to work. Fiddler's, you know, a .NET application, and Internet Explorer is all native code. So a direct port clearly isn't going to work. I think the way to think about it is, in some respects, Fiddler serves as a nice, you know, advanced prototyping environment to see the sorts of things that people will, you know, find valuable. And so certainly I talked to the DevTools guys about, you know, what does a lightweight Fiddler user do with Fiddler, and, you know, try to make sure that those scenarios are accommodated by the F12 developer tools. And so, you know, it's sort of ironic in some respects, but, you know, one of my happiest pieces of feedback from my mix talk about Fiddler was, oh, I didn't realize that, you know, all of these things that used to require Fiddler can now just be done with the F12 developer tools. I don't need Fiddler anymore. I'm going to go uninstall it. And, you know, in some respects, that's a success, you know, that people are happy with the tools that are getting provided by IE. But, you know, I would maintain that the ability to sort of take advantage of managed code and the dramatic increases of productivity that you get out of that mean that, you know, in some respects, Fiddler will have a pretty big advantage over any native code application for quite some time.
Sure. And kind of the same way you'd compare like calc.exe in Excel, or I mean, that's kind of extreme, but, you know, like the you can do some basic stuff with the dev tools, and they are pretty impressive what you can do, especially like the network and,
yep.
But then when you do get to something where you just really need to know what's going on, and like you said, the extensibility, it's good to have that step up.
Yep, absolutely. The one thing that you do get out of the dev tools that's kind of nice is the ability to see requests that don't hit the network. As a proxy, Fiddler can only see you if you hit the network, mm-hmm. whereas the F12 tools will allow you to see hits to the cache, which is something that is ordinarily invisible to Fiddler. And so that is a clear advantage for the dev tools.
And then, well, talking about that, that was something that you brought up in your mix talk, was that you have a common import-export format between the two tools, right?
Yeah. So basically, you know, during the middle of the IE9 development, the folks, so Steve Souders and I wish I could pronounce his name, the guy who's, well, so Simon Perkins, who works on HTTP Watch, but there was some other instigator who basically said, hey, we should have a common interchange format. And the HTTP Watch had published sort of an XML format that they thought was reasonable. Interestingly, it's not the default save format in HTTP Watch. And so they had published what they called the HTTP archive specification. And unfortunately, they published the specification effectively entirely in XML. So this, you know, basically all the tags and so forth were defined in XML. And in a little comment at the top, it said, despite the fact that this is being published in XML, the real format is JSON. Thank you. And unfortunately, that got overlooked by our developers tools team when they were building the export for the IE9 F12 developer tools. And so the IE9 F12 developer tools actually export in XML format, while most, well, actually virtually all HTTP archive tools export and import in the JSON format. And so that's an unfortunate disconnect. Fortunately, Fiddler has the ability to import in both formats and export in the JSON format. And so if you need to transcode the format for any reason, you can actually export from the IE9 F12 developer tools, import into Fiddler, and then re-export wherever you'd like. It turns out the number of things that actually do useful work upon importing HAR format is still relatively small, although I believe the Google guys have started to put out some interesting stuff around doing performance analysis against HAR files. And so there's, you know, some slowly developing ecosystem around that HAR format.
Okay. Another question we had from Twitter was from Luke Faust, and he's a Microsoft employee, and he asked, he was just curious about your what it's been like developing a side project while you're inside of Microsoft.
So I did a engineering forum talk about that last year. you know, it's an interesting thing. Inside Microsoft, we've got a sort of a grassroots innovation organization called the Garage. And the idea is to get grassroots innovators sort of together to kind of talk about their side projects and so forth. You know, the joke is it's all our 20% time, you know, the 20% above 100%.
Right, right.
But, you know, in fairness, the folks that are doing this kind of stuff are doing it because they love it. And, you know, most of my Fiddler work, you know, for the first, you know, when most of the work on Fiddler got done was back when I was a younger man who wasn't married and didn't really mind spending every weekend kind of hacking away and learning new technologies. And so, you know, it's been a very interesting experience. And certainly, you know, as I mentioned earlier, having lots of internal adoption of Fiddler has been really useful for kind of getting better use cases and understanding what people would think would be interesting for the tool. But it is challenging because, you know, sometimes there's the question of, well, hey, you know, why are you doing this thing, this side project? You know, isn't there something else you know, could be doing that's, you know, shipping in a Microsoft box with a Microsoft logo on it and so forth.
Right. Although, like you've pointed out several times, that your experience in working with this has positively impacted IE and other Microsoft tools over the years.
I certainly hope so.
So that segues pretty well into something else. Fiddler is by far your most well-known freeware application, I guess. But you've got several out listed on at Baiden.com, Bayden.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a variety of stuff I've done over the years. My first project of any significant size was... 1994, must have been 94. I acquired a copy of Visual Basic 3.0 on 5 1/4 inch floppy disks at the computer show and sale at the fairgrounds where I grew up. and, you know, this was, you know, the days where you still typed Win to get out of DOS and into Windows. And I missed sort of the command line interface. And so I put together what I called Quick Run. And Quick Run was a Visual Basic 3 application that was hard-coded where you could type in things like calc and it would go load calculator. And if I got a new program, I would go open Visual Basic and add a new command to Quick Run. And, you know, as you might imagine, I got pretty tired of doing that pretty quickly and started, you know, building sort of a more extensible architecture. And when Delphi came out, I think that was 96-ish. I said, hey, this is an opportunity to kind of learn this new language, and it'll be, you know, fully compiled code, which is the cool, hot new thing. It won't be any of this interpreted VB stuff.
Right.
Evil. And so I used it as an opportunity to learn Delphi. And at some point, Quick Run turned into Slick Run because it turned out there was some other guy who had some other app named Quick Run. And so Quick Run became Slick Run. And, you know, I continued to evolve it over the years. And in fact, when I had my first interview for Microsoft on either University of Maryland's campus, I had just put together a little binder of my various utilities, you know, just kind of like screenshots and an explanation of what they did. And so I kind of handed them to the interview guy and I said, well, this is what I'm working on. And, you know, at the time, this was some developer, and I'm sure he missed his command line, too. And so he got very excited. He's like, have you ever shown this to Microsoft? And I said, you're a Microsoft, right? it was pretty much my only opportunity. And so, you know, that kind of went over well. So Slick Run actually is my oldest application. It's, you know, existed in one form or another since, you know, roughly 1994. And it probably has in the order of 100,000 users. It's very old school. I don't know whether anybody saw sort of the All Things D conference about the future of Windows, but it's pretty much the antithesis of the future of Windows. But, you know, it's something that I still use. It's kind of interesting because one of the things it does is it keeps a command counter of the number of commands you've executed with it. And so, you know, basically I've executed many, many, many tens of thousands of commands across my various machines using it. And, you know, it kind of goes back to two different things. One, I'm willing to work really hard to be lazy. and so, you know, if I want to type calc to have calculator open, or, you know, now that you can do that with the Windows 7 start menu, if I want to do something more complicated, like run a search on a search engine without opening a browser, you know, I can save a couple of keystrokes and maybe a couple of seconds with Slick Run. And then the other thing is, you know, I grew up on Star Trek and so forth, where you'd tell the computer what you wanted to do rather than, you know, navigating a series of menus and so forth. And Slick Run provides that ability where you can just say, hey, go to, you know, IE internals 406 and have your browser just open to your post about HTTP 406s that you posted on IE internals. And that's possible, of course, through the magic of search engines and I'm feeling lucky buttons and so forth. But so Slick Run is certainly my next most popular application. And then over the years, I've written a variety of plugins for Internet Explorer. Probably my most popular application was I wrote a pop-up blocker back when those were cool. And mine had a very, very garish UI, many, many colors. I loved it. It turned out to be the most popular pop-up blocker in Brazil because it was the only pop-up blocker localized into Portuguese, which does give you a commanding market share. But, you know, obviously those darn Internet Explorer guys with their XPSP2 pop-up blocker, they totally dried up the market for me.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, so there's a bunch of other stuff. I have some little utilities for grabbing screen captures or flipping between proxy servers or changing your user agent string within the browser, a variety of other stuff I've written, but nothing anywhere close to Fiddler in terms of popularity.
Well, so I had one question I wanted to ask specifically about Slick Run, which was from a Twitter user. But before I go on, one of the things that I noticed here is that you've got a broadband tweak, and it modifies how many simultaneous downloads you'll get. And I know that's a question that just comes up over and over again, is about simultaneous concurrent downloads, and the numbers kind of keep edging up on each browser release.
So the general idea there is that was released back with, you know, back in the days of IE6 and IE7. And the idea was at the time, if you went to, you know, a website and you wanted to download, say, a bunch of fully licensed MP3 files, and you chose right-click and save target as, and right-click and save target as, you would find with IE7, you could do that exactly twice before your UI would basically just sit there waiting. Mm-hmm. Because IE's connections per host limit was 2 for HTTP 1.1 connections. With IE8, we actually increased that limit to 6 parallel connections per host. And that was basically deemed sort of the optimal in terms of load on servers as well as overall performance, because every additional connection that you open has a setup cost. And so in cases where you're not doing long running downloads, there's a good reason why you don't want to get your connection limit up too high. And so that's kind of the history behind that broadband tweak. The other reason that tweak kind of still is vaguely interesting is that that's that connections per host limit is what was being applied to Fiddler. And so if you had IE7 and you were using it with Fiddler, across all hosts, you would make a maximum of 2 connections. And so using Fiddler and IE7 together without upping your connection limit would result in a very, very significant decrease in your overall performance. And that correction, that problem has since been corrected in IE. And so we'll actually make 12 connections per proxy now. So that's why it's there. Just kind of historical thing. I haven't really removed or updated or modified it. I don't actually even know whether it still works for IE9 or not.
Okay. And nothing's changed for IE9. It still stayed at the same download limit as it was for 8.
So 6 connections per server. We did change the connections per proxy limit up to 12.
Okay. Right.
Previously in IE8, it was actually at 6 as well.
Okay. So the original question about all your freeware utilities, Jared Dixon, who's been on the show before, he's a developer on the Stack Overflow team. He asked if it was possible to open source Slick Run. He said he uses it a lot and would like to add some features.
I think I met him at Mix.
Okay. There you go.
it's kind of interesting. You know, it's come up a couple of times over the years, and in fact, there are a few aborted open source projects that are clones of SlickRun. There are a few. You know, at some point, I should probably write a blog post about some of those. The one that I had some high hopes for was called Magic Words. And that kind of steals one of the concepts in SlickRun, which is you can create macros that perform multi-level option, you know, multi-level functions and so forth. And, you know, the name actually was kind of fun. Magic Words was not my own creation, but in fact, it came up because I previously called them shortcuts, which was terribly confusing because you could drag a Windows shortcut to SlickRun to create a SlickRun shortcut, which was different. But someone had written a review of SlickRun in Russian. And when the woman who was translating the article for me gave it back, she's like, well, this word doesn't really mean anything in English. It's kind of like magic words. And I was like, oh, my God, that's perfect. So there's a project, I think, somewhere up on Google Code called Magic Words, which is a C-sharp port. Unfortunately, that got abandoned pretty quickly. There's some kid in California that was writing a version of SlickRun, and he sent me mail, and he had written it in C-sharp and said, hey, you know, I'm kind of doing this project. And I took a look at it. It was actually very impressive. And he's actually, as it turns out, I found this out, and I basically said, what are you kind of doing with your summer or something? He's like, oh, I actually just got a job offer from Microsoft as an intern. and so I think he's up actually this summer. I should probably go look him up. And so he's building a version in C-sharp as well. And it has a lot of sort of the things you would expect. And so my, you know, secret, not secret plan that I publicly announced, I think, in 2004 and have failed to get very far with is that I plan to rewrite SlickRun inside C-sharp. And my mechanism of motivating that is to make the quick exec box in Fiddler powerful enough that one day it will have all the code that I just pull out and becomes the new version of SlickRun. And so you've started to see some additional power appear within the quick run feature or the quick exec feature of Fiddler, partly in support of that overall goal.
Okay.
In terms of just open sourcing SlickRun itself, the primary challenge that I have is that it's in Delphi, and the number of actual Delphi programmers there are in the world that would be interested in doing this is fairly small. But it's also really embarrassing. A very significant part of this code was written in, 1999 when I hadn't really learned to code at all.
Right. Yeah, that's over the years you'll hear, well, why not just open source this old thing? And then, if you actually saw the code, it's like, well, it's, really practical.
Yeah, there's some very clever things in SlickRun in terms of some code that I used to code with another guy. He's he's now a development lead at Microsoft. And he had written some pretty clever code about how the autocomplete system works and so forth. And so there's some clever ideas there. And there's a couple of interesting things about how it interacts with Windows and kind of manages to stay on top for the most part and so forth. But for the most part, 90% or 95% of SlickRun is actually really not well written.
Hmm. Well, so I'll go ahead and extend that question to Fiddler. Is Fiddler something you would consider open sourcing at some point?
So the challenge with doing that is, well, there's a couple of challenges. Unfortunately, if I were to open source Fiddler, it may result in a lot of complications for people because Fiddler Core currently is available as a component that anybody can go put in their applications and do whatever they want with. If it were to be open sourced, depending on the license and so forth, that could cause a bunch of problems. Microsoft, as a general rule, doesn't want any sort of third-party authored code within any product that they're using. And so it could cause some problems for, Microsoft's use of Fiddler Core if I were to go that route. The other problems are, there's partly a code quality issue. Fiddler's project written by someone who was learning to write code in C#. And so there may be some, screams. One of the testaments I have, I think, to, Fiddler's improving code quality is the overall size of the code has been decreasing over the years, not increasing, despite adding a lot more functionality. My favorite example is my original NTLM authentication implementation was 3 pages of code. Now it's 4 lines. There's some aspects of that, you know, kind of that issue. The way I've been addressing that lately is, hey, give me your feature requests. If you can't, you know, if I can't write your feature for you, then, you know, maybe we'll talk about whether it's time to make that switch. And, you know, for most of the things, it's been, hey, here's the plugin model, and it's actually extremely rich. And if you can't do what you want with the plugin model, let me make the plugin model richer. And that way everybody benefits from it, as opposed to having, you know, 50 or 60 forks of Fiddler kind of floating about. You know, there's some great books out there. I think it's Producing Open Source Software. Amusingly enough, it's sitting on the shelf right above me, but my room is dark and I can't see it. That kind of talks about kind of the process of running an open source, producing open source software. It is by Fogel O'Reilly, where it kind of talks about how a lot of the issues with open source, it's really, you know, kind of a project management community role and so forth. And, you know, I'm married and not doing as much Fiddler work as I could do previously, and, you know, big full-time job working on Internet Explorer. And so managing a community beyond just kind of keeping up with feature requests and Q&A is a big commitment. And I know that there's this theory that, oh, well, with open source, you're going to have a lot more, you know, people helping you out and you'll save time. And I really haven't yet seen that happen in any project that was going well.
The one thing I have seen with this is you can, like you said, there's a lot of other complications out there, but there are open source projects where you're accepting contributions from people, and you know, that's the kind of ideal thing that, like you said, kind of rarely happens in the real world. And then there's also the just releasing code with an open source license, which you're pretty clear about saying, I'm not going to accept contributions, but here's the code if it's of use to you, or if you want to make use of it or whatever. And, you know, like you're saying, it's not something anyone has an obligation to release code like that, but at least like the MVC team does that, you know, and it's at least you've got code available if you want to make your own specific change to it.
So it's really funny, because if we were talking about anybody else's code, I would probably say, you should Google for the word reflector.
right.
But, you know, I wouldn't say that about my own code, obviously. More seriously, though, on the Fiddler blog, so blogs.msdn.com, whack B, whack Fiddler, I actually have posted what I believe to be the interesting bits of Fiddler. And so, you know, some of the code that I'm either most proud of or I had the hardest time figuring out. And so certainly if, you know, any .NET programmer out there says, hey, Fiddler does this really cool thing, how does it work? That's the kind of thing I would love to just blog about, rather than kind of shipping code out there. I would love to just say, hey, here's the working code and here's how it works and so forth, and just kind of get it out there into sort of consumable nuggets, Stack Overflow style, rather than just kind of this, you know, mess of 40,000 lines of C#. Please go hunting.
Right.
I've done that for a couple of cases, mapping, you know, one of the things, for instance, I think I did a post about how Fiddler knows which process sent a given piece of traffic, because I thought that was sort of a rather clever piece of, you know, bit manipulation. And then Fiddler's preference system, which is loosely modeled on Mozilla's, I thought was something that other projects may have use for, even though it's not particularly particularly interesting. And so, you know, I do try and get some of that code out there. The sharpest edges I'm gonna keep to myself as much as I can.
Sure. Okay, well, we've gone pretty long. We should probably wrap up here. Are there any I think we've picked your brain, you know, for quite a bit, but is there anything that we skipped that you would have liked to have talked about? Or
no, this is great. It's certainly interesting to just, you know, see the, you know, other perspectives and talk to other folks. You know, so many people these days using Fiddler aren't really, you know, kind of developers or web developers. And so, you know, that's the audience I care most about is the folks that are, you know, kind of using it for development purposes. And so kind of hearing from that community, I think is really exciting. Yeah, generally speaking, you know, I'm kind of building up to my 2.4 release of Fiddler, which will probably not be with a bang, but rather a whimper. you know, every little, you know, super minor revision version of Fiddler recently has been adding some pretty significant functionality. And so if you compare the current 2.3.4 version to the 2.3 version, wow, there's actually quite a bit more functionality. And so I want to make sure that everybody's upgraded. I have a version distribution chart, and there's still quite a lot of people that are running older versions, and I want to help, you know, push them up to the newest versions.
And on that front, I have to say, if there was one feature that I would really love to see in Fiddler, it would be an auto update feature. I could never stay up to date.
Yeah, it's something that comes up a lot. I took some feedback on that, I think in 2.3.2 or something, where instead of, you know, kicking you out to a web page, it just downloads and runs the installer, but you still have to close the windows manually. And, you know, the challenge is there is the alternative is to do a version check on boot before any traffic has been captured, and only upon the successful thing do you, you know, auto close the application and so forth. And so, for instance, what I think the older versions of Reflector used to do. And unfortunately, the result was, you know, really slow boot times in a lot of cases. And so you have to have some smarts so you're not slowing things down too much. It'll probably happen. Probably the most vocal person is a good friend of mine, and he nags me about it pretty often. And so one day, probably.
All right. Well, we should wrap up. I did, on behalf of myself, and I'm sure all the rest of us on the call, this has been a very useful, helpful tool, you know, over the years. And that was something, as I mentioned, I asked on Twitter if people had questions for you, and we just got a lot of people saying, just tell them thanks, you know. So
cool.
Yeah. So thank you.
Well, I'm around Eric Law on Twitter and, you know, Fiddler blog and so forth. So I look forward to questions, feature requests, and so forth.
Great. Okay. Well, that's all the time we have this week. So thanks a bunch.
Thanks, everybody.